Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an investigation into the role of Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio, now Pope Francis, when he was head of the Jesuit order in Argentina, and look into his dealings with the Argentine junta, who kidnapped and murdered priests during the Dirty War. Sam Ferguson, a visiting fellow at the Shell Center for International Human Rights at Yale's Law School, who is writing a book, Remnants of a Dirty War, joins us. He has an article at the New Republic, When Pope Francis Testified About the Dirty War. Then we'll assess the impending withdrawal from Afghanistan, America's longest war, and what kind of functioning state will be left behind in the hands of kleptocrats and warlords, whose current leader, Hamid Karzai, is not just corrupt, but is mentally unstable. Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point, joins us to discuss Karzai's latest outburst that has endangered the lives of American and NATO service members who he has accused of working with the Taliban. Then finally, we'll look into the growing possibility that there will be a military confrontation between North and South Korea following a warning by the North that the South should evacuate a group of islands on the border that the North shelled in 2010. Sung Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, joins us to discuss where bellicose rhetoric ends and military action begins. Joining us now is Sam Ferguson, a visiting fellow at the Shell Center for International Human Rights at Yale Law School and a former Fulbright scholar. He is writing a book, Remnants of a Dirty War, about human rights trials in Argentina, and he has an article at the New Republic, When Pope Francis Testified About the Dirty War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Ferguson.
Thanks so much, Ian. It's great to be here.
And it's pretty clear that the Vatican have gone to great lengths to reject claims that the Pope had ties to Argentina's dirty war. They came out pretty quickly after it was announced that he was the new pope, and it seems that Reverend Federico Lombardi, who's head of Vatican Radio, a fellow Jesuit, has been if there's been any changes at the Vatican, it's been he's taking on a prominent role. Apparently, the Vatican press office has been controlled by Opus Dei, which is an extremely conservative group for the last 40 years. But now it would appear that Father Lombardi is taking the lead, and he has rejected claims and suggested that some of the sources for claims that Cardinal Bergoglio, or he wasn't even a cardinal, but he was head of the Jesuits at the time, wasn't sufficiently engaged, shall we say, in helping priests who have been kidnapped by the junta. Now, let's start with that. The Vatican's claim that the source, I guess it's Verbinski they're talking about, is not reliable.
That's true. The Vatican came out with a statement that said, quote, there has never been a credible, concrete accusation against Pope Francis. And they added that the accusations are fueled by a, quote, anti-clerical left-wing elements. Now, the primary interlocutor here is a investigative journalist in Argentina named Horacio Verbitsky, who is a columnist at the left-leaning Página 12 newspaper, who has been the primary accuser of former Father Bergoglio, now Pope Francis, summarized in a book, El Silencio, that came out in 2005. The primary source for Verbitsky's accusations is one of the kidnapped victims himself, who was a father named Orlando Llorio, who, along with Francisco Halex, was kidnapped by Argentina's Navy in May 1976. And Verbitsky says that according to an interview he had with Llorio in 1999, a year before Llorio died, Llorio, in fact, blamed the current pope for his kidnapping, effectively attributing the pope's role in the incident to spreading malicious rumors about him behind the scenes and marginalizing him from the church, something that he says was effectively a green light for the military to kidnap him. There are also other allegations against the pope. The oldest one comes from a human rights activist named Emilio Mignone, who said that the Navy kidnapped the two priests based on the fact that the then cardinal of Argentina, a man named Cardinal Aramburu, had revoked the priests' ministerial licenses days before they were kidnapped. And Mignone also said that possibly, that's a quote from the book Iglesia y Dictadura, that he wrote about the relationship between the church and the dictatorship, that possibly Bergoglio had also been involved in this incident in spreading rumors.
So what do you make of the testimony of this priest? He was kidnapped. He was tortured at the Naval Mechanics School. And how reliable is the evidence that Verbisky got from this priest, who's, after all, giving firsthand testimony, if it's correct?
Yeah, well, we're still working it out. It's interesting that in the 80s, when Iorio initially testified before Argentina's National Truth Commission, and then later in a trial in 1985 against the military commanders, he did not blame Father Bergoglio in the same way. And unfortunately, now that he's died, we have no way of verifying firsthand Verbitsky's account. So it's a sort of he said, she said. Now, there are corroborating pieces of evidence to Verbitsky's story. After Halleck went into exile, according to Verbitsky, he attempted to renew his Argentine passport from Germany. And this request was denied, and there's a cable from the Argentine Foreign Ministry about Halleck's request that says they got information from Father Bergoglio that he had, quote, suspected guerrilla contact and had disobeyed orders in the church. Now, whether this is as damning as Verbitsky suggested is up for debate, but that's the other main source of evidence against Pope Francis. Now, Pope Francis's explanation is completely opposite of what Verbitsky says. He testified about this incident in 2010 and effectively cast himself as not necessarily a friend of the two priests, but described a relationship that he said was that of a fellow Jesuit, of a brother Jesuit. And he recounted many steps that he took, albeit behind the scenes, to attempt to assure the safety and release of these two priests. He met, for instance, with Jorge Rafael Videla, who was at the time an army general and dictator of the country. He also met twice with Emilio Macera, who at the time was the junta's navy representative.
And he was in charge of the main torture center, right? The Naval Mechanics School, where these priests were held.
Exactly, that's correct. He was the navy commander-in-chief, and they actually say that despite his high position, he had very close contacts with what was going on at the Naval Mechanics School, where the two priests were held by the what's called the Task Force 332. This is one of the most notorious secret spy groups of the Argentine dictatorship, and they forcibly kidnapped and tortured and disappeared at least 2,000 people, most of whom were thrown out of airplanes into the South Atlantic. Now, Iorio and Halleck survived. What this has to say about the Pope's intervention or not is obviously unclear. Verbitsky has attributed the fact that they survived to intervention from the Vatican itself, and possibly even from pressure from the army dictator, who was in the midst of somewhat of a rivalry with the Navy at the time.
Again, I'm speaking with Sam Ferguson, who's a visiting fellow at the Shell Center for International Human Rights at Yale Law School and a former Fulbright scholar. He is writing a book, Remnants of a Dirty War, about human rights trials in Argentina, and he has an article at the New Republic when Pope Francis testified about the dirty war. So I guess the fact that the current Pope, then in 1976, the head of the Jesuits in Argentina, these priests were kidnapped in May of 1976. The Pope John Paul didn't excuse me. He didn't come in till 1978. But he one of the first things that the Pope John Paul did was to start a kind of jihad against liberation theology. I mean, that was probably one of his top priorities, that he felt doctrinally the church had strayed into the political left, and he wanted to make a correction. So that's kind of at the heart of this story, isn't it? Whether there's a story here or not, given the fairly passionate denials from the Catholic Church, who on Saturday the Pope did actually have a press conference, but it wasn't really a press conference because he didn't allow any questions, but it was kind of a love fest where 5,000 journalists were completely seduced by the Pope. And
Unfortunately, I can't comment as much on what you characterize as a jihad from Pope John Paul, but the political background to a lot of this is the Catholic Church in Argentina and indeed all across Latin America was deeply divided in the 60s and 70s between a sort of new liberation theology that saw work with the poor as being a kind of paramount calling for priests, and more reactionary or conservative elements in the church who saw this as straying from the more traditional interests of spiritual tranquility and sin and harmony with God and the other world. And these two priests that were kidnapped were indeed liberation theologists. And Bergoglio, in his testimony, recalls, in fact, that he remembers many rumor campaigns circulating around the priests and others who worked at the with the poor as quote-unquote zurdos, which is a kind of derogatory term for those on the left. Now, the human rights lawyer who cross-examined Bergoglio during most of the testimony really pushed him on this point. He asked, you know, where did these rumors come from? Didn't you understand that these rumors were dangerous? In fact, several priests had already been murdered who were suspected of being quote-unquote subversives because of their left-leaning theological beliefs. And Bergoglio really resisted, you know, naming names within the church. He said, you know, these were just general rumors. I don't remember anybody specific who this was. At one point, he even said, you know, I didn't give it a lot of attention. And when pressed on that particular phrase, he backtracked and said, well, it's not that I didn't think they were important. They were unfortunately just so common at the time that I had become accustomed to these rumors. Nevertheless, there are indications that Bergoglio did do things to attempt to save the priests, at least from his own testimony. In the days preceding the coup, he offered the priests refuge where he was living, which they in fact took up after the coup. And Bergoglio has said in other interviews that he, in fact, saved several other priests and helped smuggle one out of the country after he lent them his priest robe and sent him off to Brazil, I believe it was. So it's, you know, it's a very difficult story. You have to understand at the time that people used different strategies to attempt to save people. And seeing Bergoglio in the best light, what he did here is attempt to work back channels to secure the safety of these priests. Now, of course, that butts up against the version of Iorio, who says that, in fact, it was Bergoglio that was helping spread these rumors. And I suspect as this story plays out and world attention focuses on it over the next few days, we might get a better sense of which of those versions is true.
And what is it, a Spanish word again, a slang word for those that work for the poor, like these two priests did in the Bajo Flores slum? What's the translation for it in the word?
Zurdo. It's Z-U-R-D-O. You know, I don't actually know what it means in English. It's possible it means fox, but
it's a derogatory term for a leftist.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
So there is, of course.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. I just remembered it means left-handed.
Left-handed.
That's okay. Where it comes from. Yeah.
But there were priests and even a bishop, I think, that were murdered by the regime. These two priests did survive, and it may well be because of the intervention, because the Bergoglio, then head of the Jesuit order, met twice with the dictator, Jorge Rafael Videla, and the head of the Navy, Emilio Massera. Now, of course, some of the critics have said, well, the fact that he could have a meeting with these guys, at the drop of a hat is suspicious in itself. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, the other question over what's going on here is just how much power then Father Bergoglio had at the time, that despite the fact that he was the head of the Jesuit order within Argentina, he was not yet a bishop, so he was not in the bishop's conference, which is the real nucleus of of church power within Argentina. So his story, you might read into it and say, well, he was a kind of mid-level church figure, and so that he didn't have that much power, so you can't expect him to have done, you can't expect him to have sort of saved Argentina from the dictatorship. But you have to remember, this was a dictatorship. And in many people I've been speaking with today, they basically say, you know, look, the church acted no better or worse than many other institutions in Argentina. And Bergoglio is really a figure like anybody else who was living at the time, that caught up in horrific moral situations. It's very difficult to sort of say who did what and what was good and what was bad. But as you point out, his critics say, well, he was head of the Jesuit order, which is a relatively significant order in Argentina. And the fact that he was able to secure interviews with Jorge Rafael Videla, obviously a powerful man, and Emilio Massera, another very, very powerful man who had ambitions to become president or dictator himself, is suggestive of the fact that he in fact could move some of the levers of power if need be.
So given that the main accuser of the current Pope for being to some extent in complicity with the junta, and certainly not helping one of the priests that was kidnapped. The other one, we're talking about Orlando Iorio, who is now dead. So we can't get any more information from him. But the other priest is alive, Francisco Hallis. He's in Germany, right, with the German Jesuit order.
That's correct. And in fact, Hallis yesterday or the day before came out with a somewhat ambiguous statement saying that he had reconciled himself to the past. He wrote a book in 1995 alleging that an unnamed individual had started spreading rumors about him. Verbitsky reads into this, and based on some other statements that Iorio made, that Hallis was in fact speaking about Bergoglio. But Hallis has really tried to distance himself from the past and has separated himself from this matter, and is not currently available for press interviews. I actually sent him an email the other day and didn't hear anything back. That's consistent with the one public statement he released the other day, essentially saying, I don't want to talk about this. I've, quote, reconciled with events and, quote, consider the matter to be closed.
So I guess in the broadest sense, you can't say that with any certainty that this Pope, the current Pope, then the head of the Jesuit order in Argentina during the Dirty War, was in any way in complicity. That's definitely a question. But you can say, surely, that the Catholic Church was not heroic in any sense, just as it wasn't during World War II with Pope Pius and the Nazis.
No, there are very clear indications. In fact, in 2007, there was a priest, Christian von Wernich, who was convicted of his role in a network of secret prisons in the Buenos Aires province. According to his accusers, he actually began to use the confession as an interrogation tactic within these secret prisons. The Episcopal Conference, just weeks after the coup, called on all Argentines to, quote, work for the salvation of the nation, and released a series of very ambiguous statements and the best of kind of incoherent doublespeak that at the time functioned as clear support for the military junta. There are others.
Well, they just taken over. So obviously they're saying if you're going to work for the good of the nation and these military thugs have just taken over, isn't that an endorsement of them?
Exactly. It was an endorsement of them. And although they made some statements saying that the state should, quote, respect liberty or conserve liberty, they also made statements such as, the state cannot, quote, renounce its duty to exercise legitimate authority, even if that means coercive means. So they were sort of speaking out of both sides of their mouth at the same time. And in the context, it was seen as clear support for the military junta. As I mentioned earlier, the church was not the only one. Even outlets such as the Buenos Aires Herald, which would soon become a kind of heroic newspaper and reporting on the many disappearances, gave a somewhat glowing editorial the day after the coup, calling the coup leaders, you know, men who had finally restored order. Argentina had had a long history dating back to 1930 of military intervention, and this cycle of weak civilian government military intervention was constant throughout the 20th century. So perhaps at the moment of the coup, nobody could really see the ferocity of what was to come. But the church, in fact, made positive statements about the military junta long after it was clear what they were doing in secret.
Well, the irony is, of course, that it took Margaret Thatcher to get rid of them.
That's true. The 1982 conflict over the Falkland Malvinas Islands, which the military junta lost, led to their collapse and the restoration of democracy in the country, which reached its peak with a 1985 trial of all of the military commanders. But unfortunately, the country was forced to pass an amnesty law after the military rebelled in 1967. Yeah, excuse me, 1987.
87, right. So just in closing then, Sam Ferguson, given the emphatic denials from the Vatican and the love fest that's going on with the new Pope, the Pope of the Poor, Francis, is it likely that we'll get any more clarity on this? I mean, I think you know the subject better than anybody. And it's not clear in your mind, is it, from what I gather?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, Verbitsky obviously has looked into this much, much, much more than I have, and I'm really getting up to speed in the last few days. But we'll see what happens. Some very prominent human rights activists, such as Adolfo Perez Esquivel, who won the Nobel Prize, have come out in Pope Francis's defense and said that some bishops were accomplices with the dictatorship, but Pope Francis was not one of them. Bergoglio, Pope Francis, one of his good friends, is actually a woman, Alicia Oliveira, who is a very prominent human rights lawyer and activist within Argentina. So it's a tricky story, and it in fact might simply just be the story of thousands, even millions of other Argentines who were trapped by this horrific dictatorship where, you know, our normal moral beliefs and commitments are thrown into tremendous turmoil. And it becomes very difficult to decide, you know, what's good and what's bad in those sorts of situations.
Right. But on the other hand, when horrible things like that happen to a society, it does bring out the best and the worst.
That's absolutely true, and nobody would argue that the church as an institution, that this was their best moment by any means.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Sam Ferguson.
Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Sam Ferguson, who's a visiting fellow at the Shell Center for International Human Rights at Yale Law School and a former Fulbright scholar. He is writing a book, Remnants of a Dirty War, about human rights trials in Argentina, and he has an article at the New Republic when Pope Francis testified about the dirty war. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about America finally getting out of its longest war. چشمان مسته سیاحت مبند نازنی نازداری به موی کمند از اول جلوه ها میکنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی و چند. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, thank you for having me, as always.
And This recent statement from Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan suggesting that the U.S. military and NATO are working hand in glove with the Taliban has forced the U.S. military to increase security to protect their own troops, who are, by the way, subject to these internal attacks from people that they're training in particular. Is that what essentially is happening there, that Karzai is basically signaling to the Afghan people that the Americans are the enemy?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, obviously one of the most outrageous provocations that we've heard from President Karzai in a good long while. But it's not the first. I mean, if you go back and you look at his statements going really back to the beginning of the Obama administration, Karzai has made a number of very dubious assertions and has been increasingly trying to make it appear as if he is distancing himself from the Americans. And there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, we are going to be withdrawing not soon enough, in my opinion. And what's going to keep him alive or dead is going to be his standing amongst Afghans. And so I think what he is understanding is that it's politically expedient for him to distance himself from the United States and NATO. You might recall a few years back, he made a number of comments about Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, being Afghanistan's closest ally. So he's got a history of saying things that are quite bizarre. In fact, there's been a growing body of literature about his mental health issues, about his need for medication, and about his instability.
Well, Christine Fair, I remember speaking a long time ago to Peter Galbraith, who was the United Nations deputy head in Afghanistan, and he was trying to force the UN to force a new election because the election of Karzai, the re-election of Karzai, was so fundamentally and so flagrantly crooked. The head of the UN basically cut the legs out from under him and sacrificed him, and they didn't clean up the electoral process. And at the time, Peter Galbraith said that Karzai's nuts. He's a manic depressive. He's bipolar.
That's pretty much the word on the street. I don't know anyone that hasn't interacted with him that hasn't come to that conclusion. There was a pretty explosive article written about him. I was actually an election observer for that election in 2009. And at the time, there was an article, I believe it was in the New York Times magazine, or maybe it was in the New Yorker, but it was a very detailed exposition about his mental state and how deeply fraught it was, and about his propensity to engage in emotional outbursts. But, be that as that may, I'm not going to detract from what appears to be a consensus that he has significant mental health issues. He is not irrational in trying to distance himself from the Americans. In some sense, there's no cost for him to distance himself from the Americans because we're leaving anyway. And what the Americans would like as a condition for our staying are things that he's not terribly enthusiastic about. And so, anything that he can do to sort of micturate in the bathwaters is quite frankly to his advantage. So he might have mental health issues, but what he's actually doing is very much strategically and politically calculated to try to appeal to whatever base he has remaining.
But if it's as bad as people tell me who've been there, and there was a devastating BBC Panorama documentary recently on the fact that there's no functioning government there and that the military are a bunch of stoned out conscripts, and the police are incredibly corrupt, and the whole thing is just going to probably collapse as soon as the U.S. gets out. That seems to be a fairly common belief. So if that's true, then who's going to protect Karzai, or is it just going to be like South Vietnam, and all these crooks go and join their money that's already deposited abroad?
Well, that's my sense. For years, we've talked about Afghanistan on this show for years. I have been an opponent of this surge. I argued years ago that the strategy that we've pursued is a losing strategy because we cannot win counterinsurgency with the resources that we have at our disposal and with the so-called partnership that we've had on the Afghan side. So from the beginning, this has been a losing proposition. What I think is happening is that Karzai is doing exactly what you said. Unlike Najibullah, who was the poor chap that inherited post-Soviet withdrawal of Afghanistan, even though there were no Soviet troops in Afghanistan, he was able to hang on because the Soviets did keep giving money until circa 1992. And he was able to do that because he actually was able to more or less manage a more or less functional patronage system in which he gets money and he pays it downward to those constituencies that are necessary to keep his head on his shoulders. What Karzai has done, rather than building a patronage network, which is what Najibullah had, he's actually built what Sarah Chase has, I think, brilliantly described as a vertically integrated extraction network, whereas patronage redistributes resources downward to the communities that you're dependent upon. What Karzai has basically done has built a giant machine that sucks up the money from increasingly lower levels and basically has deposited them along with his cronies in places like Dubai, Europe, and elsewhere. I think that if there had been some sort of international convention, I don't even know if such things are legal, to require Karzai to stay in that country and live out his life in Afghanistan, in other words, he's made a bed, he's going to have to sleep in it, maybe we would have seen a different Karzai. But I think what he's definitely doing is he's feathered his beds in other countries. And as soon as the going gets rough, he's going to split. Remember, in 2014, he won't be the president in any event, unless something strange happens to the Afghan constitution. I don't really see him mucking around with the Afghan constitution to allow him to be a president for yet another term. So we don't even know who's going to be at the helm of Afghanistan when and if we finally, take the last soldier out of Afghanistan.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fayers, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So what do you think is going to be left behind in terms of the U.S.? There's been an argument over that. In fact, the top general in Afghanistan, he asked for double the number of troops left behind that the administration had first indicated. But
let me just say about these generals, I am so dismayed by these generals and also their Beltway bandits and their other allies in think tanks and in policy communities that have been behind this. You know, it's been said now a couple of times, I think it bears being repeated, if a private loses his weapon, he loses his career. Generals consistently pursue bad policy. They have lost this war. Needless Americans have died since the surge. You know, circa 1,000-ish, about 10,000 Afghans have died. And there's absolutely no accountability. And these generals are absolutely shameless. They keep asking for one more fighting season. They keep asking for more troops. The fact of the matter is, deferring diplomacy to resolve a war that cannot be resolved through fighting is reckless and dangerous, and these generals should be called to Congress to account. I'm sick and tired of these generals running policy, and I really wish that President Obama would get some scrotal fortitude and actually put some leadership behind this campaign.
But isn't Obama concerned of, remember in the Vietnam War, Henry Kissinger's famous phrase, a decent interval? In other words, you don't want the feces to hit the fan until, you know, you're well out of the place and people have forgotten it.
Well, so, the problem is, of course, I mean, the feces has been hitting the fan. In fact, there has never been a time since 2004 that the feces has not been regularly coming into contact with the rotary oscillator. So this is just a fiction. I think we could very easily construct a narrative that this thing was lost when we decided to change the goalpost in 2004. In 2004, we had met our objectives. We had ousted the Taliban. We had defeated al-Qaeda, and we had removed them from Afghanistan. At that point, we should have perhaps jettisoned into a development mission. But this idea that making sure that we have in place secure Afghan national security forces, a functioning Afghan government. You know, this is utter nonsense. This was nonsense of the highest order. And, you know, quite frankly, it's imperial hubris that anyone thought that the Americans could do this. You know, I often, you know, I'm a scholar of South Asia. That's what I do. I look at the institutions that were built up in India as a consequence of British colonialization. And, you know, the Brits were in the Indian subcontinent in one way or another for more than 200 years. So this idea that you could build these sorts of institutions in a matter of a decade, it's risible. So I think it's time for the Americans to sort of demand that we bring our troops home. I don't believe there's anything in Afghanistan that is worth spending any more of our treasure and spending any more of our lives. And quite frankly, the longer we stay, the more Afghans die too. So I think forget this idea of a reasonable interval before the defecation hits the rotary oscillator. The rotary oscillator has already been completely covered in the defecation.
So,
to use your analogy.
I think we should.
Scatological discussion.
I agree. We should put this to rest. So it sort of reminds me, Chris Fair, of the Rudyard Kipling poem about looking at the grave of a British officer, a soldier in Afghanistan. The last line of which is, "Here lies a fool who tried to hustle the East." So it's not a new story, as we know that Afghanistan's been referred to as a graveyard of empires. But
which I think is also sort of silly. I mean, it's not a graveyard of empires. The fact is, Afghanistan has been conquered about 12 to 13 times over history. It's just that is conquering a country really what we're supposed to be doing? You know, there's a little bit of a joke in these counterinsurgency campaigns. When counterinsurgency campaigns have worked, it has largely involved genocide, right? So, seriously, Malaya, genocide. When the Indians defeated the Sikhs in the Punjab, genocide. Sri Lankans putting down the Tamil Tigers, genocide. So, you know, this idea that you can win a counterinsurgency campaign without doing things that are absolutely prohibited by international humanitarian law is a joke. And I really do think it's time that the Americans hold the military and political leadership, and quite frankly, the Beltway bandits that have profited from this war in incredible significant measure. It's time that we hold all these people to account and find a way to get home.
Well, what happened in 2004, obviously that was at the time of the re-election of George W. Bush. And we know in Obama's case that he made a campaign issue out of Afghanistan saying, we dropped the ball in Afghanistan and lost focus and went into Iraq and I'll do it better. So he dug himself into the hole. But what happened in 2004?
Well, see, basically, 2004, we can sort of look back ex post facto and see things that had been changing. By 2004, and certainly by 2005, the Pakistanis had really come to a different conclusion about what was in their best interest. The Pakistanis saw the writing on the wall that even though the U.S. was working with Pakistan to wage the war on terror, and in fairness to Pakistan, there were many al-Qaeda captures that would not have been possible had it not been for Pakistan's cooperation. Be that as it may, the United States under Bush, with the policies advocated by Ashley Tellis and Robert Blackwell, were really one of wooing of the Indians, and obviously culminated in the Indo-U.S. civilian nuclear deal, which is impossible to overstate how much that affected the Pakistanis. And, you know, if you were President Musharraf, you had to have been whipsawed. Here you are. At that point, you're already in the beginning of an insurgency. You've already lost several hundred troops. And here the Americans are giving your nemesis a bomb-friendly nuclear deal. So Pakistani calculus began to change very quickly. In addition, we know that at around 2005, that's when the Taliban began their regrouped offensive to launch the insurgency. Up until 2005, there had really, at the end of 2005, the insurgency had begun. So in 2004, in some sense, that was the sweet period. We'd ousted the Taliban. We weren't there trying to engage in grandiose nation-building or state-building exercises. And that was really the time that we should have pulled our troops out and simply began, what we do elsewhere, which is just running sort of a development program, you know, training some troops, continuing USAID, you know, the maternal and child health programs that we do. But the problem was is that we continue to change the objectives, and it went from rousting al-Qaeda from Afghanistan to basically defeating the Taliban. And I think there are two things that really began to go wrong as time evolved. One, you had all of these generals that had really become political generals, and they had a lot vested in this notion of counterinsurgency and what had happened with the so-called surge in Iraq. And, of course, I think history will show that the so-called surge had nothing to do with the turnaround that happened in Iraq. But nonetheless, those same generals, like and their coterie of not quite generals, they wanted to show that this could also work in Afghanistan. And I think that when Afghanistan became a testing field for new concepts of war fighting, that's when things really began to change to the Taliban's favor. Because, of course, the Taliban were not like al-Qaeda in Iraq, which were foreign. The Taliban are local. And the idea that you could kill the Taliban and thereby dispense with the problem was folly from the beginning. So, I say 2004 was a sort of a sweet spot to reoptimize, but we can say that with, in some sense, the luxury of looking backward.
Well, just in closing, Christine Fair, just turning to Pakistan, a country that you're deeply familiar with, Pakistan's prime minister just hailed as a victory for democracy the completion of a full term by an elected government for the first time in the country's history.
Well, it actually wasn't the first time. People are wrong when they say that. The first time it happened was actually the previous government before this one. So this is actually even more important, it's the second constitutional transition. No one wants to count the first one because it was voted in under Musharraf's tenure. But that term, that parliament did serve out its complete term, and there was a peaceful constitutional transition. So this is even more important than people want to say.
Even though the leader is widely considered a feckless, corrupt, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm talking about Ashraf, the
Zardari.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Yeah, look, people say that about him, but quite frankly, that's politics in Pakistan. What people haven't noticed, and I'm not going to exculpate Zardari for all of the corruption that his government has engaged in, because other governments have done the same, including the military regimes, for Christ's sake. But what people have not noticed is that his government, more than others, did his government passed the most legislation. I remember meeting a legislator in 2008 who said to me, darling, I just don't want to legislate. And my question to her was, then why are you a legislator? You chose to be elected. You could have done something else for your living. But so this is a very different, in some sense, politics is quite different now. In addition to that, even though the National Assembly, the parliament, hasn't been on a collision course with the military, they've been involved with national security affairs, something that Pakistanis haven't seen civilians do in a very long time. And this sitting president, despite all of his problems, is the first sitting president to devolve massive powers from the center to the provinces. And he's the first sitting president to devolve presidential powers back to the prime minister. So a lot of people want to focus on his cronyism, on his patronage, and all of those things might be well and true, but to not look at the actual gains of this government, and quite frankly, the political acumen of Zardari in negotiating a veritable minefield over these last 5 years to make sure that his government hangs on, that is a feat that really is worth applauding.
And, this is a man whose wife was shot.
Well, blown up in a suicide attack and then shot.
Yeah, exactly. And we don't have time to get into who did it.
Right.
But I thank you so much.
Oh, who did it.
I thank you so much for joining us, Christine Fair.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, the former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who's a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about whether or not the North will attack South Korea. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sung Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. And he's also a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research in the Korea Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sung Yoon Lee.
Thank you for having me.
And what do you make of North Korean's propaganda website saying, urging the South to evacuate the islands, some of which were shelled in 2010? Is this a threat or a promise or what?
The threat this time around is credible, I would say. North Korea is very good at psychological warfare, and it prefers graduated escalation. Over the past week, we know North Korea has really said a lot of things, from launching a precision nuclear strike against Washington and South Korea to wiping out a South Korean island near the location you just mentioned, the site of the deadly shelling in 2010. I would say this is not your typical North Korean bluster and broadside, because the confluence of events over the past several weeks, the past couple of months, makes a North Korean deadly yet controlled, limited attack quite possible.
So what is the South doing? Are they evacuating these islands?
Well, there's been some counter bluster by the South Korean government as well. And, you know, this creates enormous psychological, in pragmatic terms, political pressure for the new South Korean government. Park Geun-hye, Korea's first ever female elected leader, just assumed office in late February, and of course does not really want a North Korea crisis on her hands, President Park, that is. But North Korea, of course, is trying its best to paint the new South Korean leader into a corner. This disrupts the livelihoods of the citizens, the residents of those islands, engaged in fishing and so forth. They've been evacuating. They've been conducting drills, emergency drills. This is a major disruption.
So the North, of course, have been in their propaganda against the new South Korean leader, have sort of resorted to sexist kind of remarks, have they not?
Yes. A few days ago on Wednesday, they added a sexist twist to their bluster and mentioned that mentioned something with respect to swish of the skirt, which is an old traditional chauvinistic Korean expression for aggressive or assertive women. So the message is the woman president, Park Geun-hye, should know her place and not say things. She's actually given some stern parental guidance, if you will, to the 20-something-year-old North Korean leader. She said she'll deal strongly with North Korean provocations, and she also said this kind of bluster and nuclear weapons development can only lead to North Korea's collapse. They're doing this, spending so much money on their weapons program, while the people are going hungry. That's what she said.
Well, you know, for the longest time, Sung Yoon Lee, the North has been belligerent and said amazing stuff and talking about a nuclear attack on the United States. And as you know, new Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel announced a couple of days ago that the U.S. is going to increase its numbers of interceptors in Alaska. Although my interviews with physicists and others who know the program, this interceptor program, say that this thing is completely untested. So he may be spending an extra $1 billion, but nobody knows whether these missiles are going to work, these interceptors, in the first place. But it leads me to the point which I think is inescapable, and that is that the border between North and South Korea is the most militarized spot on the earth. It's the most dangerous spot on the earth. And if things start to get out of hand, you could have an unspeakable conflagration.
That's right. I don't know about the physics, the technological aspects of any missile defense system, but we can be reasonably sure that North Korea is committed to further developing, enhancing their nuclear weapons and long-range missile technology. They've been at it for many, many years at great cost, at great sacrifice. And the ultimate objective is, of course, to be able to demonstrate to the U.S. and to the world that they have the capability to combine a nuclear warhead with a long-range missile that can potentially reach the United States. The objective is not to fire such a missile at the U.S., but to demonstrate that it can, and to try to coerce or threaten the U.S. and South Korea, especially on the issue of U.S. troops in South Korea. So North Korea has a long-term objective in this. And if there were a war, that would be a disaster. At the same time, we know North Korea is not suicidal, so I don't think they're on the brink of launching an all-out war, even as they say such things.
So tell me then, Sung Yoon Lee, how do you start a war and limit it at the same time? I mean, this is what I guess you're suggesting. They're going to do something like what they did last time. Remember, they sunk a South Korean warship, and then they shelled an island. And in both cases, the South sort of, you know, turned the other cheek, as they say in Christianity. So, the South already said they're not interested in turning the other cheek. In fact, she has said, the new leader, that she'd go after the North Korean leadership.
Yes, her defense ministry spokesperson said that. That remains to be seen, because it really doesn't pay for South Korea to indefinitely escalate things with North Korea, although it may pay for Pyongyang to provoke, because South Korea has become an affluent country over the past generation. The South Korean people have so much to lose in terms of lives and treasure in the case of a war, and the public will not support continued escalation. The public is quite wary of such an indefinite escalative tension with North Korea. And North Korea knows that is one of South Korea's weaknesses as a democracy, as an affluent society with much to lose. And they're doing their best to engage in this psychological kind of warfare, instilling fear in the South Korean population and putting enormous pressure on the South Korean government to go back to negotiations with a lot of concessions in tow.
So you've got a regime in the North that's under increasing international sanctions. They've very defiantly said they're never going to give up their nuclear program in exchange for any kind of deal. And you've got this young dynasty, leader of this dynasty in the North, needing to assert himself. That's the conventional wisdom, to prove his, you know, cojones, if you will, that he's a sufficient leader for this highly militarized state. But he's free to cause mischief, but up to a point. And then you're saying on the South side, they don't really want to escalate, even if they're provoked, because they've got too much to lose. So where's that line drawn? That's what's hard for me to understand.
Yes, it is a fuzzy line, and this has been the pattern over the past 60 years. This year marks the 60th anniversary of the end of the Korean War, which ended with a ceasefire agreement. I would say, although it's been unstable at times, most recently, as we saw in 2010. The situation in the Korean Peninsula, although it's been unstable, we have had de facto peace, no all-out war in and around the Korean Peninsula over the past 60 years. And you might say that South Korea's passivity in not having really retaliated on any occasion on the numerous, really countless occasions that North Korea has provoked over the past 60 years, that kind of passive stance has facilitated, furthered the protection of peace in Korea. So it's a torturous situation for the South Korean government. What do you do? Do you counter when North Korea attacks? South Korea probably will. What if North Korea threatens to do it again or does attack again? Do you counter again? Perhaps. What about the third time? At that point, I don't think the public will support that.
Well, but you also, just in closing, you've got the U.S. there, 30,000 troops. You've got them conducting a military exercise at the moment. So what kind of tripwire is that? I mean, the U.S. hasn't laid down a card, have they, saying if you attack the South, we'll nuke you? I mean, what's the U.S. policy?
I think nuking North Korea is out of the question, and probably South Korea would not wish for that either. It would create certainly the impression that this is disproportionate use of force. At the same time, I think the U.S. over the past 60 years has sent an unequivocal message to North Korea: you launch a war, we will fight, and we will march into Pyongyang. And that's why stability, power of balance has been maintained in the Korean Peninsula. The essential role of the U.S. troops in deterring North Korea, that's a major point that North Korea understands for now.
So just in closing, then, I get the impression that what you're saying is that in spite of all of the bellicose rhetoric, there is a kind of stability and nobody's really going to rock the boat too much.
Well, of course, South Korea has to suffer from time to time the indignity of controlled deadly attacks. But I think the consensus within the country is that suffering that kind of indignity is far better than escalating things and having a war in Korea. Because we know the last war 60 years ago was so devastating, simply the most destructive, devastating event in all of Korean history as it was.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sung-Yoon Lee.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korean Institute at Harvard University. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.